Welcome everyone to our morning session in Second Life. Today's talk will be on a subject that I think I've talked about before, but it's been a while. And probably useful for people who are new. It's called the Path of Purification. This is the subject today. The teaching of the Buddha is described as a path of purification, or the path of purification. It's understood that there are certain things in the mind which are impure. And you can give them whatever name you like. You can call them evil. You can call them unwholesome, unskillful, unbeneficial. The meaning is those things which affect the mind in a negative way, bringing about negative consequences for both oneself and for others. This is a core principle of Buddhism, that these things exist in the mind. And not only do they exist in the mind, but they can be cured. So the whole of the practice of Buddhism is the development of those things that will purify the mind. And the path is said to be comprised of seven stages, and these are called the stages of purification. It's just a traditional means of breaking the path up into its component parts, to make it clear the progression. So the first thing that we have to do, the first stage of purification, is called the purification of virtue, or the purification of morality. Morality plays a crucial role in the teaching of the Buddha as being the very first quality one has to accomplish, very first practice. one has to accomplish. And this is often missed by people on the spiritual path. One thing about purification is it's the path leading inward. It's a path which allows us to pull back and come out of our ordinarily diffuse and distracted state. So it has to start by cutting off the most external manifestations of impurity, and slowly work its way inward until it actually changes the seemingly hardwired habits that exist in our minds. If we're not able to remove the coarsest manifestations of impurity, our actions and our speech then there's no way we can ever get to the point where we're even able to see the more refined impurity. It's like if you can't change the basic, your basic and gross bad habits, you'll never be able to fine-tune your mind on a deeper level. So we start with morality. We start with restricting and circumscribing our physical reality. Though there are certain things, certain actions, and certain modes of speech that we have to refrain from. Because of their innate connection with the defiled mind. So traditionally this is said to be giving up a certain list of activities. We give up killing, we give up stealing, we give up cheating, lying, taking drugs, taking alcohol. We give up harsh speech, abusive speech, useless speech. And we take these certain rules of conduct that we're going to refrain from these things. But the real point of morality and the reason why it's the beginning of the practice is because true morality is something that still occurs in the mind. It's the absence of intention to even perform an unwholesome deed of body or speech. It's the very beginning of the meditation practice. So there's this idea that you have to take on certain vows, that I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to do that, and that somehow that is the essence of morality. And in fact, it's not. When you take on vows, when you promise yourself, you know, when you accept the Ten Commandments in Christianity or Judaism or so on, it has no direct bearing on whether or not you're going to perform those acts or not. The meaning of morality in a Buddhist sense is really the beginning to meditate. When you go into your room, you sit down on a pillow, You close your eyes and you direct your mind towards understanding things as they are, you're accomplishing morality. You don't ever have to have made any vows whatsoever. You don't have to have promised, I'm not going to kill, and so on. Morality is accomplished at the moment that you direct your mind towards seeing things as they are. Because it's through not seeing things as they are, it's through directing our minds elsewhere, directing our minds towards the proliferation of mental construct that leads us to like and dislike things and to commit evil and unwholesome deeds. So morality is the basic practice of bringing the mind back. When you're sitting in meditation and your mind wanders, the act of bringing it back is the morality. Because when you don't bring it back, the wandering mind leads you to make decisions. Suddenly you remember something else you have to do, or something you'd rather be doing, or the stimulus in front of you, whether it be pain or however, makes you decide to change, makes you decide to react, to act physically or verbally. And when someone yells at you and you start to get angry, if you don't quickly say to yourself, angry, or, you know, remind yourself and refocus your mind on what's really happening, it will lead you to commit immoral acts. By simply refocusing your mind, you do away with the immoral act. At this point, we're not talking about doing away with mental impurities. The understanding is, when you start to meditate, you're still going to get angry, you're still going to get greedy, you're still going to have your wants and your likes and your dislikes and your aversions. Morality is the battle with these states, so that they don't lead to physical or verbal impurity. The point being that when you do and say bad things, you're only causing suffering. And if it wasn't causing suffering, we wouldn't call it a bad deed. If you believe that killing living beings is not causing suffering, then in your mind that's not considered a bad deed. No. The only reason we call these deeds bad or evil has nothing to do with the fact, directly to do with the fact that the Buddha said they're wrong. The reason he said they're wrong is because they're wrong, because they cause suffering for the doer, and they cause suffering for the receiver of the act. Okay, so that's the first goal in meditation. It should be said, though, that taking vows and promising to not to do certain things, whether it be acts of body or speech, killing, stealing, and so on, is good and useful, is important. It's important to get it straight in your mind, those things that are going to cause suffering. But it's far more important to redirect your mind so that you don't give rise to them. And that isn't accomplished by vows. It's only accomplished by mindfulness, by clear awareness of reality. Okay, so once you start to develop morality, and this is once you've sat down on the meditation mat and your mind is starting to focus, starting to come back to, starting to really see things as they are, as opposed to turn them into something more than that. The next purification is called purification of the mind, or purification of mind states, purification of citta. And it's funny, a literal translation here would generally be purification of mind. But we don't want to say that, and that's not what's meant here. Because, of course, the purification of the mind is the ultimate goal. Now, what is meant here, the word is citta visuddhi. And it means purification of individual mind states. This is an important, very important distinction. Because what's really important, the sort of the distinction between what the Buddha taught, from a Buddhist point of view, what the Buddha taught and, say, what a Hindu meditation teacher would teach, is, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, the fact that there's a difference between purifying the arisen mind states or the present mind states and ensuring that such impure mind states never arise again. Because you can purify your mind quite easily. You know, you can sit down, focus on an object, your mind is pure. Focus on a light, focus on a sound, focus on God or so on. And your mind becomes very pure. There's no greed, there's no anger. There may not be even any delusion arising. And yet, when you stop meditating, those very mind states have the opportunity to arise again and will arise again because there's something missing. So just to make a clear distinction here, this is only the second purification, the purification of the mind. It's this basic practice of meditation where your mind focuses to the extent that you're no longer angry, you're no longer greedy, you're no longer worried, confused, bored, and so on. Where you're actually able to see things as they are. Where you're actually focused. It's the creation of pure mind states. Because this isn't the ultimate goal, but it's necessary to reach the ultimate goal. And just to skip ahead, what the difference is, or the real cure for the mind is the wisdom and the understanding that comes from looking at reality with a pure mind. So this pure mind is going to be the tool that we use to look at reality. It's not the goal, but having a pure mind, a pure mind state, creating a clear mind, allows you to see things as they are, allows you to gain this last and final purity of wisdom, of understanding. And once the understanding comes, you don't have to talk about pure mind states, impure mind states. You can't give rise to impure mind states because of an understanding of the impurity and an understanding of reality as it is. Someone yells at you, you see it for what it is. You see something, you know, attractive, you see it for what it is. You're not able to give rise to greed, anger, or delusion. It's not possible, since these things come about because of misunderstanding. So, okay, here in the second purification, we're talking about concentration, focus. Because as you bring the mind back, as you apply the mind to reality in the present moment, your mind becomes focused. And this is the quality of meditation practice that we should strive towards. We're not just sitting on a pillow and trying to count the minutes. We are trying to evoke a quality of meditation practice so that when you do walking meditation, your mind should be with the foot. You should really know that you're walking. When you are sitting, your mind should be with the object of meditation. In the case of the practice that I teach, should be with the stomach, the rising and the falling motion. Your mind should be focused, and you can experience this if you start to practice. If you practice the technique that I teach, I guarantee in a very short time you should be able to experience pure mind states. You know, your mind will not be pure overall. We're not there yet. But just in a short time, you'll be able to see that, you know, you say to yourself, rising, and it's actually quite pure. Your mind is calm, peaceful. It's even quite pleasurable at times, you know, in between all of the chaos that's in the mind. Your mind becomes focused. And it really only has to be one moment at a time, because we're trying to see reality as it is in the present moment. So you don't have to build up this high, this heavy concentration that is continuous. No, for the purposes of our practice, we're trying to create a clear thought in the present moment. And this will change the mind and calm it down naturally. The third purification, once you've focused the mind, begins to get into the final goal already. This is the beginning of wisdom. So Buddhism splits the path up into three parts generally. Here I'm talking about the seven stages, but if you want to reduce it, you can reduce it down to three. The first one is morality, the second one is concentration, and the third one is wisdom. So the next five purifications are all about wisdom. To recap, we've gone over morality already. The next one is purification of the mind, or in other words, concentration. And 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are going to be all about wisdom. So number three is the purification of view. The Buddha placed a great emphasis on the purification of view, opinion, of understanding, of point of view or opinion, way of looking at the world, etc. Our way of looking at the world is obviously going to influence our reactions to the world. If we see the world as, or if we see our experience of the world as self, soul, me, mine, if we see this body as an entity, if we see the mind as an entity, if when we look at things we make value judgments about it as being me and or mine or right and wrong and so on, it becomes very difficult to break away from our attachment to things, and it certainly doesn't allow for the kind of objective introspection that we require. Because when you think of the mind as an entity, you're unable to break it down. Anything that comes up, you think of it as belonging to the entity. You know, there's pain comes up in the body, you think of it as my pain. When the body's moving, you think of it as a permanent, lasting entity. There's really no problem here, and we don't have to make it an intellectual exercise necessarily. The problem comes with the fact, especially when dealing with non-Buddhists, that we do have quite strong views on this subject. We believe in a soul, we believe in self, we believe in the intrinsic, hardwired nature of defilement. You know, I'm an angry person, that's just who I am, it's genetic, etc., etc. We have very fixed beliefs about reality. The Buddha called these niyatamicchaditti, which means niyata means certain wrong view, where we're sure of something, but it's wrong. If we're sure of something and it's right, that's not a problem. The problem is that many of our views are based on speculation or improper evidence. I mean, nowadays a good example is the reliance on classical physics to explain reality, the materialistic nature that the mind doesn't exist, it's a product of the brain, and so on. And therefore all of our idiosyncrasies are hardwired and deterministic. I'm reading an interesting book, just to get off on a bit of a tangent, talking about explaining quantum physics. And the wonderful thing is that it's been about 100 years already since quantum physics disproved this idea that that the physical reality explains everything, that we are deterministic beings. Quantum physics requires a mental process of evaluation and decision making. I think that's a good example to bring up, because for most people it's a given that for many people in modern day, it's a given that we are material beings, we are physical entities, and that consciousness is just a inoperant side effect of the brain's working, which is totally against modern physics, surprisingly, happily. So, but if we can do away with, or at least suspend our skepticism, you know, be open to the idea that we might be wrong. This is really the key to scientific inquiry, and it's a shame that science falls prey to the same things, that sort of things that they criticize. They call it well, there's an example of something called methodolatry, where if you can't prove something by a specific method, in this case the modern scientific method, then it's not true, or it's not scientific. And so something like meditation is thought of as, you know, a way of relaxing, or you know, pseudoscience or whatever. And in fact, we're talking about an incredibly scientific inquiry, and If you focus on reality as, you know, go through these stages, start with morality, then focus your mind, you're going to start to see certain things. And the first thing you're going to see is that inside of us there is no solid entity. In empirical fact, there is only a flux of arising and ceasing states. And whatever you can, whatever results you can come up with in the lab, you know, they turn out to be merely an approximation of what's really going on, and that in reality we're talking about a mind that is not whole, but mind states that exist, that come and go. First you're thinking of watching the rising and the falling of the abdomen, then suddenly your mind is off wandering, totally unrelated. And watching the mind arise and cease, when you move your right foot, you know the right foot is moving. When you move the left foot, you know the left foot is moving. But it's not the same knowing, it's not the same mind state. You can see the difference, that when you move your right foot, the knowing arises and ceases. When you move your left foot, the knowing arises and ceases. And the mind is constantly arising and ceasing. And that there's also the physical reality. But the physical reality is also not an entity. The body is not a solid object. When the stomach rises, there's emotion. There's an experienced reality of the pressure arising. when the belly falls, stomach falls, there's a reality of a release of pressure, and so on. So you begin to see that inside of yourself, or in reality, there are only two sets of phenomena, and these sets of phenomena are not permanent, are not entities in any sense of the term. They arise and they cease. The physical reality is a series of phenomena, and the mental reality is the same. We watch the rising and falling. There's a mind that knows the rising, and then there's the rising of the abdomen itself. They both arise and they both cease. Then there's the falling, which is a different object entirely, and the knowing of it. What you start to see is that the idea of the body or the mind was just a concept. It's just a thought. It's just a belief. And you start to give up this idea. This is important, incredibly important. It starts to get a little bit technical, I know. But it's incredibly important as a concept, and to really get a feel for this. Because it's what's going to allow us to break away from this craziness that we find ourselves caught up in all the time. You know, getting angry about things. Can you really get angry about bits and pieces of reality? It's like getting angry at atoms. Getting angry at things that arise and cease, at nothing, at non-entities. So for instance, when a person yells at you, says something nasty to you, the reason why you get angry is because you think of it as a person. You build up this reality in your mind of a person yelling at you. The reality is there's sound that has touched the ear. There's a mind that has become aware of it. And then more mind states arising that process, judge, evaluate, and make decisions based on it. And when you see this is how the reality works, you can see there's a problem here. There's a misunderstanding, a misapprehension, a misunderstanding, and a incorrect judgment that leads you to act inappropriately and create suffering for yourself and for others. Once you see how it works, you can see where you go wrong. And you don't give rise to the kind of thoughts that, oh, that person said nasty things to me. You're able to see what's going on in the present reality. This can be accomplished when someone says something to you and you say to yourself, hearing. You know that you're hearing at that moment. And you start to realize that it merely is what it is. There's no negative or positive value inherent in it, inherent in the experience. You know, we don't want to get angry. When people yell at us, we'd much rather be calm and collected and be able to respond in such a way that brings about happiness. But we misunderstand. We don't see the process going on. And so when the results come out, we're amazed that, you know, we don't know what went wrong, and we're unable to understand how to correct the situation. We react inappropriately because we don't see things clearly. Once we start to see the process, you know, piece by piece by piece by piece, from the beginning to end, then obviously we can direct it. We're in charge. We see what's going on. We see the reactions, and we see the causes. We don't give rise to the idea of self, of soul, and so on. So this is this purification of view, the giving up of the illusion of self or of solidity of the reality of our experience is the first step. It helps us to see what's real, what's really going on. The next thing that we'll see is how it works together. Once we understand that what exists, that there is no solid entity, there is no soul, no self, and so on, in the experience of reality in front of us, then we start to see how it works together. This is called purification by overcoming doubt. And specifically here, doubt in cause and effect. Doubt in regards to what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. So once you see that reality is made up of pieces, made up of building blocks, of atoms, so to speak, then you start to see how they work together. As I said, someone yells at you, the sound touches the ear, the mind receives it, the mind remembers it, recognizes it, processes it, and then begins to respond to it, getting angry, upset, and finally responding with anger, with unwholesomeness, and eventually leading to suffering. This is the fourth purification, and this one is the explanation for those people who have a hard time understanding karma. Karma is not something that is intellectual or based on faith or based on past lives or so on. Karma is something that how you realize and understand and accept karma is by seeing how it works in the present moment. By seeing how getting angry leads to doing bad things, which leads to suffering. How being mindful leads your mind to be calm and content, and leads to your peace and happiness. To see that we're creating the problems that exist in our mind at every moment by ourselves, without the help of anyone. To see that we are the cause of our future, the cause of our destiny, that we are our own creator. You know, we have all these mental issues. Everyone always talks about being depressed or paranoid or afraid or stressed or worried, insomniac, tempered problems, so many different issues that people have, addiction. And we have all these scientific explanations. And the scientific explanations generally fall back on the idea that there's nothing we can do except, you know, find some external means of blocking the process. So we take a pill, we find a way to not have to deal with the problem. They always say it's genetic, it's a chemical imbalance in the brain, and so on. And I don't deny that such things can exist, that the brain has chemicals in it. But this is the interesting thing about quantum physics, is that quantum physics works at the level of the brain. I was just reading this description of how it goes. The neural pathways in the brain are linked, and they have contacts. And at the contacts, there is chemical reactions at an ionic level, at the level of atoms. And that's where quantum physics starts to work, where it requires a mental observation or a mental decision or reaction to actually get anything done, to give rise to reality, to give rise to the result. We have a very important part in the makeup of our brain. We can't change the chemicals. We can't stop our minds from giving rise to the process of addiction and so on. But we have a choice as to how we're going to react to it. You want something. It's up to you whether you're going to, how you're going to react to that wanting. You experience a pleasure, a pleasurable feeling. Now, normally that makes you want the object of your desire and run to get it. Or are you experiencing something unpleasant, maybe a pain in the body? You can't change that. You can't stop yourself from feeling the pain. But where the mind comes in is it has the ability to make a decision, to decide what is that, or to decide the next step, to give rise to karma. It's a very real thing, and it exists in every moment. And it's through the building up of our decisions, deciding that something is good, that something is bad, that something is me and mine, that we give rise then to wholesome and unwholesome mind states, greed, anger, delusion, and their counterparts. And eventually giving rise to action, whether it be action that brings peace and happiness or action that brings sorrow and suffering. In fact, you can see in the meditation, the first thing that you start to see once you're clear about what it is that you're looking at, is that really everything works in cause and effect. You can't change who you are in one fell swoop. You can't turn pain off when it arises. You can't stop yourself from getting angry once it's arisen, and so on. But you have this moment-to-moment ability to be the cause for the next moment, so that when you are angry, you have the ability to make a decision to see it for what it is, to stop the cycle of building it more and more and more, not going back to what it is that's making you angry, judging it again and again and again, and building it up more and more and more. When you say to yourself, angry, angry, you've stopped saying this anger is bad or this person is bad or so on, and you're just starting to say this is this, it is what it is. When you when you fail to see things as they are, this is the moment-to-moment cause and effect, creating results and eventually suffering. So you start to see the way things work, and you start to be able to manipulate this in the meditation. The next step is starting to manipulate this, starting to manipulate in the right way, starting to react in a proper way. And this is starting to find the path. It's called the purification by understanding what is the path and what is not the path. What is the way of dealing with these things? When mind states arise, when physical realities arise, what do you do? How should you react? And this is sort of the defining moment in the meditation practice. And it's where most meditators, especially those without proper instruction, falter and are unable to proceed. Because at this point, your mind has calmed down, you're able to see things fairly clearly. And there will be many different paths that present themselves. Split into two sides. One set is not the path, and one set is the path. And for the most part, We run into great difficulty at this point, because we fail to We fail to see things for what they are. We fail to find and approach the right path and to find the right way of dealing with things. Once you start to meditate, in the very beginning, we're following a lot of wrong paths anyway. We're getting angry, we're getting greedy, and so on. We're giving rise to great stress in the mind by nature, because that's how we approach reality without meditating. But once you start to meditate, what you'll find is that you start to feel very peaceful and calm. You'll find that your mind has calmed down. And you might see bright lights or colors or pictures. You might experience profound states of quiet, emptiness, happiness. You might begin to realize things about yourself and about the world around you. There are many things that arise that seem to be positive, seem to be the right way of practice. And we tend to cling to these things. When we see bright lights, it's quite common for people to cling and to think that there's something in that. When you experience states of buoyancy, your body feels light, your body feels maybe tingling all over, maybe your body is rocking back and forth. You experience a lot of, there are a lot of experience that are going to bring us back to a state of clinging and stop us from progressing on the path. What we're talking about is how to deal with this, with our relationship with reality. And we've done away with the gross defilements. We're no longer getting angry or greedy and so on. But we still have this work to do to purify our path, to find the correct way of proceeding. So most meditators will get caught up on things like things that I've mentioned, these positive states where you feel calm, where you feel peace, where you feel happy, where you start where you experience great energy, where you feel light, as though you're even flying, floating, and lose sight of the path. It's at this point where we have to start to change our minds. We have to start to change the way we look at things. And the problem, I guess, is that people have already very specific ideas of what meditation is, that meditation should bring states of peace and calm and magical experiences, special experiences. And so it's important to understand that what we're really trying to do is become objective about all of these things, to not have any preference for any experience whatsoever, because all of these experiences are impermanent and insubstantial. They don't last. They aren't under our control. And so the important thing is to realize and to change the way we look at things in terms of simply seeing things for what they are. From beginning to end of the practice, we're simply trying to experience reality as it is. The problem is that once you start to practice, you very easily lose your way, especially when you don't have a teacher to guide you every day. Something good comes up and you're no longer impartial. You've begun to cling again. You're back on a path of enjoying something, attaching to something, following after a dead end. So this is the important point, that what we're working up to in the practice is to change the way we look at reality, so that we are simply seeing absolutely everything, whether it be positive or negative, for what it is, as it is. at the moment that it arises. Once we do that, once we get past this point where we're able to confirm in our minds that the correct way of responding to reality is just to see it for what it is, then we really begin the path. And so number six is the practice of the path, the purification through practicing the path, through doing the work of examining reality for what it is and learning, truly learning about reality. No longer clinging, no longer seeking, no longer looking for anything. Simply watching, learning. This is the purest, most ultimate form of study that one can ever undertake. Pure and complete examination, perfect examination of reality. And this is the true practice of the Buddha. It takes you know, five stages before this to actually get to the point where you're really practicing. And this is an important point, that mostly when we begin to meditate, the difficulty and the reason why it's often quite discouraging is that we're doing it all wrong. We haven't yet come to an appreciation or yet come to a method of practice that is proper. It's like surfing or skateboarding or any type of physical skill. You do it all wrong for a great period of time before finally you get into your groove and start practicing in the correct manner. This is very true with meditation, and it's important to understand that most of our practice is going to be simply adjusting and adjusting our practice to the point where we're practicing properly. Once you're practicing properly, actually looking at things, seeing things as they are, examining reality moment by moment by moment, then the true practice begins. This is number six. Number seven is the realization of the truth. And it's the summum bonum of Buddhism. As I mentioned, it's the realization of true wisdom, or the attainment of true wisdom and true understanding, where you're able to see reality for what it is. It's kind of like, in one sense, it's the shift of the mind, where it's the breaking point, where your mind finally accepts the truth, finally accepts the fact that nothing in the world is worth clinging to, that there's no benefit that comes from attachment, addiction, wanting, and that there is nothing in the world that is truly a self or a soul or me or mine. That no benefit comes from attachment, comes from clinging. And so the mind releases, the mind lets go. This is the realization of the Four Noble Truths. In one moment, it's like they say when you light a candle, there's light, there's the light comes on, the darkness goes away, the wax melts and the wick burns. In this way, the Four Noble Truths arise, all four simultaneously. The realization of suffering is just that nothing is worth clinging to, that suffering comes from clinging, comes from attaching to absolutely anything, that there's no possible way for any part of reality to bring, for any arisen phenomenon to bring peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. The realization of the cause of suffering is that clinging. The cessation of suffering is the letting go. And the path, the realization of suffering is with the end of the clinging, and the path is the realization of the cause of suffering. So in a sense, it's kind of like practicing can be many weeks, months, years, whatever, for one moment, for one epiphany, this final realization where the mind shifts and says, it really isn't worth clinging to, and lets go. This letting go is the realization, incidentally, of Nibbana or Nirvana. When we talk about Nirvana in Buddhism, this is the moment that we're talking about, where the mind lets go and is released. The realization of Nirvana is really indescribable. There's no bright lights, there's no feelings of happiness, there's no thought that this is Nirvana. All of that has ceased. It's like the mind is turned off, in a sense, is cooled, is quenched. All of the phenomenon, all of the things that arise that we normally have to contemplate in meditation disappear. It's like the mind has unplugged itself and come back inside and is released. It's the ultimate state of peace, happiness, and true freedom from suffering. So that's just a fairly technical look at the Buddhist path, and we've gone on quite long. It's a little bit difficult to explain, and I apologize if it got a bit convoluted at times. I sometimes have a hard time bringing all these concepts to the Western world, trying to fit them in to our way of looking, our way of seeing things. But thank you all for coming, and I hope it was in some way beneficial. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I wish you all a very good day and success in finding the way out of suffering to find peace, happiness, and freedom. Have a good day.